Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, January 10th, 2020. It's our first roundup of the year since we had last week off. And this is when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, and Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy New Year. And joining us later will be Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Mike Dean up at the State House. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Jeff, let's start this week with a story that Cindy McCormick reported. It's about how police on the Lower Cape are having to wait for extended periods to get help when dealing with mental health emergencies.
That's right. Cindy took a look at this this week, Steve. There's an organization called Bay Cove Human Services. It's based in Boston, does have a presence in Hyannis. In 2017, they took over what they call the mobile crisis response activities from the Mass Department of Public Health. So Cindy took a look to say, you know, we're coming up on almost 2 years. How is that working? And if you speak with some of the police officers and police departments on the Lower and Outer Cape, they pretty much saying, you know, it could be working better. Sometimes they are told when they have to encounter some of these situations, they don't know when they get a call what they're walking into. It could be someone dealing with about a severe depression or even just a severe psychotic episode. They need some help. They're police officers. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, they've had training in how to intervene with this, but there's a need for a specialist. And at one point, the Chatham Police Department, the chief there said, sometimes they're told, and you know, we'll catch up next day, when in fact they need the help right now.
You can see this is a mental health emergency that they're responding to.
Exactly. And Bay Cove did have a plan to open a satellite office on the Lower Cape. I believe it was in Orleans, and that's not materialized yet.
That's something that we talked about on this program, I think, a year ago, when they had gotten a grant somewhere around a year ago, and they said part of that will be put towards opening a satellite office somewhere around Orleans.
Exactly, and that hasn't happened yet, but what they're telling us is they do now have an employee working out of the Harwich and Wellfleet Police Departments one morning per week. And this grant, this $200,000 grant from Blue Cross Blue Shield, which they, I believe, recently received, is also going to allow them to send more clinicians into homes and emergency rooms where these patients are being treated or where they're residing. The organization, Bay Cove, did say that part of the issue is they're in trouble finding and hiring clinicians in this area.
These kinds of calls are so time-consuming for officers to respond to. And as you say, they're police officers. They're not necessarily trained in mental health response. They have some training, but they're not social workers.
They're not. And we're seeing some pretty significant increases in calls regarding mental health issues. I think Bay Cove had said on the Outer Cape there were 36 calls last year. And for the first 9 months of 2019, it was up to 55. And police departments, at least 15 of the 16 here in the Cape, I know there's 15, I don't know where the 16 is coming from, have had some type of training on how to deal with this on their own. But once again, that certainly doesn't replace a clinician coming in and helping right away.
And before this company, Bay Cove, took over, as you said, it was the State Department of Mental Health that had a crisis team, and they essentially had a pretty good reputation for being there 24/7.
They did. And what some of the folks here, including the National Alliance for Mental Illness, are saying, the ideal situation here, as we look at it, as it currently stands, would be for Bay Cove to have satellite offices in Falmouth or Orleans. And that way they could pretty much cover the entire Cape, because there certainly is that void. And I should mention that NAMI, which is, I just mentioned, the National Alliance of Mental Illness, is the organization that has been providing training to police departments. Mm.
Jeff, you reported this week on the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office and pensions, and actually, I guess I should start at the county level. The Barnstable County Sheriff's Office is under state control, but the county has been on the hook for paying into the pensions for the office. It's a lot of money, and now the county says, hey, it's time for the state to take on this cost.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. I don't think a lot of people know about this, but the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office, as well as the Sheriff's Offices for Plymouth, Bristol, and Norfolk counties, all went under state control in 2010. Totally so divorced.
Those sheriff's offices, they're state employees.
They're state employees now. They used to be county employees, but they left behind their pension obligation with the county, which has a very limited source of revenue. The county, the funding for the county that funds all of the services they provide here on the Cape, it comes from variable deeds, excise tax, registry fees, and town assessments. Sheriff's employees no longer contribute to the pension fund yet, but the county's paying it out, and it's becoming quite an issue. It's taking up a significant amount of the revenue the county takes in. So last week, the county commissioners voted unanimously to send a letter to Representative Aaron Michaelowitz, who's the chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means on Beacon Hill, looking for support for a bill that Sarah Peake had filed last year. And that bill is asking the state to please take over this unfunded mm-hmm. liability from the county.
So tell us, give us a sense of how much money this is.
Sure. They're predicting for fiscal year 2021, which budget's being developed right now, that the obligation is going to be $1.7 million. Now, that's 50% of the local taxes that the county takes in.
So 50% of that, the tax income to the county is going to paying the pension fund for...
It's going to Boston to pay for state employee pension funds. And they're predicting by 2036, it will take up 64% of the local taxes. So with more of that money going out to pay for these pensions, the county is having to look at possibly cutting services. And they already have. A water quality monitoring program has been cut, as well as a coastal explorer program. And what's interesting here is in 2014, the other three counties actually had corrective legislation to fix this, 4 years after their sheriff's department was taken over by the state, which leads you to wonder, well, where was Barnstable County? Speaking with Representative Peake, she said it didn't appear as if there was any interest at the time to be included.
To be part of that, yeah.
Yeah, so I spoke with Leo Kakunis, who was a county commissioner elected in 2014. I said, well, what happened there? Because it seems like every other county, they're free of this now. He said that there was a general thought that it may not be worth it in the long run because the state with the other counties reduced the portion of registry excise deeds tax that they were receiving to help pay for this undefined liability. And Leo told me that, yeah, so when all of this obligation is met, you're still getting a lower portion of the tax. I think he was thinking way ahead.
Yeah. So, but between now and the time that all your pension fund obligation is met, that's a long time to be paying out such a high amount of percentage of the tax income there.
Exactly. And Jackie Units, who's a county administrator, says to date, $10 million of funds coming from Cape citizens to fund the county have gone to Boston to pay for the pensions. And if it is not transferred back to the state, eventually it could be $40 million. Mm.
The town of Dennis has joined a number of other communities around the local region banning the use of a specific herbicide that's raised concerns.
Yes, it's called glyphosate. And Dennis this week did join some other communities here in the Cape in banning use of it. They did, and that's on town-owned property. And they did give a temporary exemption for the town's two golf courses. For those of you who aren't familiar with this chemical, it's found in weed control products, most notably Roundup. And I think that's the one a lot of people know about. And East Ham, Falmouth, Mashpee, Orleans, Sandwich, and Wellfleet also have some form of ban in place. And it's also banned within 39 countries throughout the globe.
And yet there's still a lot of contention around this, whether this, even within Dennis, whether this ban should have been put in place. A lot of people feeling like it's not appropriate to go in with this ban right now.
Yeah, a lot of people do have questions about this. It is a legal substance. And the chair of the Golf Advisory Committee in Dennis, and that is actually a post, said we may be jumping into something we don't know about. And the Golf Course Superintendents Association of Cape Cod also chimed in and said, you know, Dennis, if you're going to be looking at carcinogens, you might as well ban hamburgers on the grill, beer and wine, and cigarettes.
Some people take issue with that, saying this is a poison that's being applied in the environment.
Exactly, exactly. There was there are two local biologists that Chris Legere, who wrote the story, did speak with as well. And surprisingly, one said this could be short-sighted and could place a town on a slippery slope. Mentioned that some organic alternatives for weed control include lots and lots of salt, And you need to consider what may happen using that as well.
But one of the things I thought was great, it's so interesting in this article, Dennis Selectman, Christopher Lambton, it turns out he has a degree in chemistry mm-hmm. and he owns a landscaping business. And he responded to all of this by saying that he wouldn't work with this stuff. He doesn't want it on his hands. This is mm-hmm. not stuff you want around. And here's somebody who's right in the thick of it saying, look, this is not something we want. And in the end, the town came down on that side.
They did. They did.
Let's see. Jeff, you covered a nice story about a family-run motel. It's been kind of a local institution around Hyannis Harbor for a long time, and it is now changing hands.
It is. For the first time since it was built in 1963, this is the Hyannis Holiday Motel. It's on Ocean Street. If you're familiar with Ocean Street, it's across from where the Highline docks are. There's probably three or four different motels there, all seem to be of the same vintage in the 60s. Mm. This sold on New Year's Eve for $4.7 million, 72-unit property. And I spoke with the two brothers whose family owned it, actually built it back in 63. And they grew up there summer since they were very young. In fact, one of them was 2 years old. I should mention, too, the property was sold to the Newport Hotel Group, which owns 8 boutique hotels here in New England and Wyoming. And even one here in town.
They own the Falmouth Inn on the Square right here.
Inn on the Square.
In Falmouth, yeah.
And they also own the Hyannis Harbor Hotel and Tower, which is very adjacent to where this location is. So they're going to have a significant presence on Hyannis Harbor. But I spoke with the brothers. James Hurley, he's 65 now, and his brother Stephen, who's 57. They met with me. They reminisced. They showed me the first brochure that was published for the motel in 1963. And they said, you know what? We were jacks of all trades. We grew up there. We were lifeguards. We did the laundry. We made beds. And neither of the men has children to bequest the motel to. So they decided, and they are young, fairly young. At this stage of life, they didn't know if they really wanted to commit or go through the process of refinancing the property for capital improvements that would inevitably be needed.
Obviously, it's an older hotel.
It's an older hotel. And so Jim Early said to me, well, we thought maybe somebody can do something magnificent here. And since the news of the sale has broken, they have received calls from all over the world. It had a very dedicated group of guests that came year after year after year.
It's fun to hear these stories because in your piece, you say that some of the guests who came year after year even put plaques in the rooms that they always requested.
They put plaques, and the Hurleys did not mind that. And he said almost became family to us. They came back, different generations of the family repeated that. They're also hearing from students and J-1 workers that they've had over the years.
And some celebrities stayed there?
Celebrities. Superman stayed there. Christopher Reeve. They mentioned Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons and, of course, some Secret Service for the Kennedy compound. But these two are not retiring by any means. James Hurley runs New England Maritime, which is a Coast Guard-approved school for boating safety and licensing. He's run that 34 years out of the motel property. But the classroom training is now going to be held at the Maritime Museum in Hyannis.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker with us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. Jeff, thanks for coming in this morning.
You're welcome.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, and we are discussing the top local news stories of the week. Right now, the FBI has been interviewing people connected to the Oak Bluffs Fire Department as it conducts an investigation. Not a lot of details are known. The FBI is pretty tight-lipped about ongoing investigations. With us to explain a little more about what we do know is Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, Noah. Thanks for joining us. Noah, it seems this investigation may be focusing, at least in part, on billing for ambulance services.
Yeah. So, mumblings basically have been going on about the probe for a long time. At one point recently, the town administrator called it the worst-kept secret in town. But it was unclear what exactly was being investigated. But this week we received confirmation from employees of the fire department who had been interviewed by the FBI that the probe basically revolves around the finances of the department and specifically focuses on ambulance billing. It's our understanding that at least four subpoenas have been issued for federal grand jury testimony in Boston. Some of the testimony's happened. Some of it's going to happen in January. But yes, apparently it does involve billing practices or something of that regard. The topic has actually briefly come up at a selectmen's meeting in the past in the town. Last September, I think the town administrator and ComStar, which is the town's billing agent, they had heard rumors that there was an inquiry happening, and so they went back and did an informal audit of their finances and found that the town had overbilled about $37,000 in Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements for rides that didn't end at a Medicare and Medicaid facility. And that's you can't actually do that, I guess, according to the Medicare rules.
This is complicated because even these ambulance services, these are leaving the island, a lot of them, and that's what's kind of that they're looking at,
right? It's a tricky situation because Oak Bluffs is the town that, they have first right of refusal on the ambulances that leave the hospital, and, the hospital is in the town, and it's an expensive service for them to provide because, the ambulance goes to the ferry. They often have to go off, and then they drop someone off with someone else, or they drop the patient off with someone else, but then they have to cover those charges. But according to the town administrator, that practice of charging for rides that didn't end at a Medicare and Medicaid facility, that had ended in 2016, and that was when the town became aware of the rule. It's just that the bills have remained outstanding, and he said that they're trying to credit them back. So as far as he can tell, that was all, I guess, they have discovered. I talked to the town administrator this week, and they haven't noticed any other billing discrepancies. So I think the FBI probe is still kind of a mystery what exactly they're looking into beyond that, or if that is what they are looking into, then maybe, but it could be something else too. Yeah, it's pretty complicated stuff.
Is there a sense of how long this might go on or what the next step is?
Well, we know that there is grand jury testimony that's going to be held later in the month. Beyond that, it's pretty much unclear. As you said, the FBI, their protocol is we neither confirm nor deny investigations. So no, we don't know. But there is sort of on another front, and there's no evidence that this is related to the issue at all. The fire chief, or the town has settled a sexual harassment and discrimination claim against the fire chief, and this happened back in the fall. So there's kind of just a lot's being brought up here, and it doesn't look like it's going to quiet down anytime soon.
Is there concern around the whole state of the fire department with all of this going on and the emergency response?
Yes, I think there is. But I think that the truth is that the whisperings about this kind of stuff have been happening for a while, and I think a lot of people within the town are at least I talked to the chairman of the board, Brian Packish, this week, and I think his feeling was, it's hard to not be able to comment on this stuff, especially the FBI thing. I feel burdened by this, and I think that, the fact that it's now coming out in some ways is an opportunity. It's kind of a reckoning, and it's an opportunity for the town, as it moves forward to show, how it's going to respond to this. Yeah,
it does seem like the amount of money that they're looking at there, $37,000, isn't a whole lot of money in the big scheme for the FBI to be devoting
right.
all of these resources. One would think, just from the outside, not knowing really what's happening. But yes.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think that is, that's part of the discussion that's going on. Basically, it just is showing us, there's probably something else here. And the Oak Bluffs is the only town on the island that has this thing called an ambulance reserve fund. And that's mainly because they're the ones who are responsible for, bringing hospital, this essential service of bringing hospital patients off the island. And so they have to have this extra sort of money and to be able to make sure that ambulances are equipped and that they have the right, basically outfits for everyone who's doing this essential service. Mm-hmm. But there was $50,000 in that fund when we checked most recently, and this is just about $30,000. You have to imagine there's probably more here.
Noah Asimo, the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The town of Chatham got a boost in its effort to build a new senior center with an unexpected gift. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle to talk about it. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, you broke this story. The town is poised to hold a special town meeting to discuss buying a property for a new senior center, which was by no means a done deal when this unexpected news came out. Tell us.
Yeah, last Friday, the day before town meeting was scheduled to convene, William Marsh, the owner of Eastward Companies, announced that he would donate the property that the town was looking at as a potential site for a new senior center. It's 1.3 acres at 1610 Main Street in the center of the West Chatham Village. The town had been expecting to go to town meeting to debate buying that property from Mr. Marsh for $750,000. But in his announcement that came last Friday, Marsh said that, you know, after talking to his family over the holidays and talking more to town officials and selectmen, he decided that he would gift the land to the town in honor of his parents. He said that he's basically lived and worked in Chatham for 50 years, raised his kids here, and he felt that this was the right move to make. So when town meeting convened, less than 24 hours later, voters went and discussed that gift instead of spending the money. You know, there was still a spirited debate about it, even though the land was going to be given to the town free and clear for a senior center. There were a lot of people who were against the site specifically, not against building a senior center, because there's been pretty much agreement across the board that the town needs a new senior center. The senior population is growing, and the current senior center was sort of jury-rigged over the years and isn't really adequate for the needs of the Council on Aging.
And they've looked at several different sites. I mean, this has been such a journey even to get to this point.
Sure, it goes back a decade, when they first started talking about it, and the senior center sort of took a back seat for many years while the town built a new fire station and built a new police station. So the seniors kind of feel it's their turn, and the selectmen really did at least two or three individual searches for a property. They looked at all town-owned properties. And then they looked at, they solicited private property, potentially land that would be suitable for a senior center. Last May, they had decided that a parcel of town-owned land off of Middle Road, which is near the town's transfer station and sewer plant, was the best site. They brought that to town meeting, but voters rejected spending $6.6 million there. Because they thought it was too isolated. This parcel in West Chatham is right on Route 28. As Selectman Jeffrey Dykins pointed out during the debate Saturday, it's right on the RTA bus route. It's near shops and restaurants. It's really a high-profile piece of property.
And where are we going to go from here now?
At this point, there will be a feasibility study. Voters Saturday also appropriated $130,000 for this study to determine conclusively if this site is suitable. There had only been sort of a conceptual investigations of it, but now the town's consultants will really go in there, decide if the property is suitable for a senior center, how much parking can fit there. The property slopes off steeply at the back, and there's concern that that's going to be a problem if the parking lot has to slope in the back, or if there has to be a huge retaining wall, that it's going to add to the the cost. The preliminary cost had been about $8.5 million for a two-story, 11,000-square-foot facility. So this study has to be done in time for the May annual town meeting. Mr. Marsh's gift is contingent on voters approving construction funds for a senior center at that May town meeting. So if that doesn't go forward, the gift doesn't happen, the town goes back to square one.
That is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
One family owns quite a number of rental properties on the Outer Cape, properties that aren't luxurious. They're typically rented by working people or people with disabilities. The problem is a lot of these properties are also under scrutiny for improper health conditions and years of unpaid taxes. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent took an in-depth look at this story, and she joins us now. Good morning, Casey.
Hello. How are you, Steve?
I'm well, Casey. Tell us about this family that owns these properties.
Okay, yeah, the Del Gizzi family, they began to buy properties in 1959, and they were in the home moving business, and they actually had a lot of tiny or small cottage colonies, little hotel units, moved to their various properties from the Cape Cod National Seashore. And so over the years, they've collected up to nearly 100 units of various formats, from former hotel rooms, cottage colonies, or just kind of hard to describe, but places with small 1- and 2-bedroom units that have over the years morphed into year-round housing that's critical and is used by lots of Jamaicans, as well as the elderly and people with disabilities who just really don't have any other choice.
I guess part of the challenge here is that as these properties, either there's back taxes or there's health issues with the properties themselves, but the town doesn't want to see these people. These are the only options for many of the people who are living in these properties.
Yes, that's right. So town officials have tolerated pretty blatant problems with those places for years, and I'm talking like chronic non-payment of taxes. In Truro, the Del Gizzis owe $268,138 in back taxes for their various properties going all the way back to 2011-2012. And then there's in the Truro Motor Inn, where their taxes are actually up to date. They have put refrigerators, microwaves, stoves into these motel rooms. They're really absolutely not equipped electrically or septic-wise for that kind of intense year-round use. So finally, recently, the towns have been getting tough collectively, and it's kind of paid off, I have to say. The Truro Motor Inn is going to go to court on the 15th, and they will ask, the town officials will ask to put the Truro Motor Inn into the hands of a receiver, who will then collect the rent from the remaining people staying there, which, granted, has gone down a lot since all the publicity started. But anyway, they will use the rent to renovate that place, hopefully without evicting people in the long term. And then in Eastham, where, again, they have tons of property and they owe a lot in back taxes, they've paid off a good portion of the taxes after the town took two of the properties for tax title, non-payment of taxes. So in Eastham, they're almost caught up on their taxes, $130,000, I guess, they recently paid. And then in Provincetown as well, they have one property in Provincetown. They had 5 units, chronic issues, all sorts of different things. But it was recently taken over by a brother named Dana, who lives in California, and he paid some of the taxes, and he repaired the heat, which sadly had not been working, even though it was used year-round. Mm.
We don't have the time to get into this, but one of the great things about this article, I think, that you did here is that you not only profiled the problems with the properties, but you took some time to profile the folks who are living there and that depend on these properties year-round. I encourage folks listening, go to the Provincetown Independent and look at that, because to me, it's such a strong part of the story to know who's living in these apartments and who's dependent on living in these really substandard conditions right here in our community. Thank you so much, Casey, for the story.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Thank you so much.
Nantucket is facing a burning issue, a proposal to extend life of in the municipal landfill. Joining us to explain this is Josh Bowling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the island's landfill is running out of space, which I guess isn't a surprise for many folks.
No, not necessarily, and being on an island makes it that much more difficult to come up with either more space or another place to put the trash in another community, perhaps. So our former FinCom member, Finance Committee member, and worker at for the FAA out at the airport, Clifford Williams, when he heard that the landfill has about 10 more years of usable space left at the current rate, he came up with a way to keep the town dump from filling up. He wants to see the town burn the trash. He's got a citizen's petition on the April annual town meeting warrant that would appropriate an as yet undetermined amount of money for the installation and operation of an incineration facility, one either capable of burning non-recyclable solid waste and converting it into energy through gasification, or one that would melt everything down into oil or refined fuels through a process called pyrolysis. It's time the town really starts thinking about prolonging the life of the landfill, he said, and keeping potentially pollutant materials out of the groundwater and out of the surrounding ponds around the landfill, which is located on the west end of the island in Matticat.
So what is what's the response when somebody says, oh, we should start burning the trash out here on Nantucket?
Well, the response so far has been mixed. There has been some concerns, as one might imagine, and this is not the first time that incineration has been proposed on Nantucket and in other communities. But the Nantucket Land Council has some concerns. Their resource ecologist said that burning trash could introduce pollutants in a different way. It introduces ash into the ponds, perhaps. It introduces contaminants into the air. The jury's still out in a lot of places on whether incineration, even more recent high technology in incineration, is an environmentally sound practice. He did agree, R.J. Turcotte, the Land Council ecologist, did agree that the island has to do something about what he called its trash issue moving forward. But for now, he said the town really should be working harder to reduce its waste stream and recycle and not burn it. And that's something that the Department of Public Works Director, Rob McNeil, who oversees the landfill, said as well. The town has rolled out some changes in its waste separation and composting programs in the last year or two, and he says those are working. He says that the waste stream is slowing down a little bit into the landfill, but more needs to be done. But for now, anyway, town meeting voters are going to get an incineration proposal at the April town meeting.
Town election, Josh, comes in April, but it's like an early spring already as political candidates have started popping up. Tell us about this.
It really is. On Nantucket, candidates start pulling their papers at the earliest available moment, and that is in the second week of January. Select board member Jason Bridges on Monday was the first candidate in any race to pull his papers for the April 14th town election. Planning board chairwoman Judith Wegner also pulled papers for a second term on the board. And former Sconset Market owner Mark Donato, who ran unsuccessfully for a five-year term on the Land Bank Commission, also pulled his papers for another run this year. Nomination papers for all seats up for election on the Select Board, the School Committee, the Historic District Commission, the Planning Board, and others are available in the town clerk's office, and they must be returned by February 18th with the signatures of at least 32 registered voters for inclusion on the ballot. So there's plenty of time left for those considering running for office to get their signatures, not really that many, even in the slow time of year, and get them back to the town clerk's office in time for the April election.
That is Josh Balling joining us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. New Bedford is continuing an effort to curb panhandling by making medians uncomfortable places to stand. Not everybody is behind this effort. Jeanette Barnes has the story in the New Bedford Standard Times, and she joins us now. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning.
Jeanette, explain what the city is doing here.
Right. So New Bedford is not overrun with panhandlers. I wouldn't want people to get that impression. But there are a few choice intersections on busy streets like Route 6 and Route 18, where people who do panhandling sort of hang out in the median. There's raised areas, of course. And the mayor's office, the mayor's administration, has decided to put these angled Belgian block in set with set with the edge upward so that it's difficult to walk on that area. And the idea is to stop panhandling. He says it's a public safety issue, that people could get hit there. What it's really about depends on whom you ask, though.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say that it's about the, sort of the image of the city and panhandling, alternatively, also about trying to deal with poverty and homelessness in a more useful way or a more appropriate way. The city began doing this back in 2018. What happened here Monday and Tuesday, they pretty much increased the size of one of the one of the areas of those blocks that's on Route 6 near Buttonwood Park. So some of the intersections that have those and have had them since 2018 also have a sign that says change the way you give, and it encourages people to give to this Rise Up for Homes, which is actually a city-sponsored initiative that funds the overflow homeless shelter in the winter. You know, this when it's very cold out, the city opens additional homeless shelter space, and that's what that money goes to. So, yeah, but the city council is very divided on whether this is an appropriate approach or not. Some support the mayor, some don't.
Jeanette, I want to ask you about another story you've got in the paper. You picked up the scent of a story from a Cushnet. It's about tracing an odor to its source. Tell us about this.
Right. So people, we had been seeing these complaints on the what's kind of a community Facebook page for a Cushnet. It's called All Things a Cushnet. Since at least October, there have been these repeated complaints about these odors in town. I was trying to get around to following up on it, and finally I did this week. There is a man who owns an agricultural property. He doesn't do like really intense farming, but he does raise some beef cattle and hay the fields. And he has been accepting compostable material there for years. People online were saying they thought it was cranberry waste and stuff. But it turns out that around October, he started taking shellfish waste.
Shellfish waste.
He was not.
To compost.
Right. So you're mixing a fish product with all of the usual compostable materials like leaves and grass and vegetables and stuff. He was not permitted by the state to have shellfish waste in his compost pile. And there was a state inspector came out on Monday because someone in the community lodged a complaint. So now he's been told that he can't do that. He says that he actually stopped before the state inspector came out, that he had decided over the holidays to stop because a neighbor of his spoke to him directly about the odor. He thinks it's resolved. Whether the rest of the community thinks it's resolved, I think maybe it remains to be seen, because if the odors continue, people will certainly continue to post on Facebook about it.
It's Jeanette Barnes from the New Bedford Standard-Times. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Okay.
A building cited for having 8 illegal apartments has created a bit of controversy on Martha's Vineyard, in part because the owner is a well-known figure, and in part because people on the island need places to live. George Brennan joins us from the Martha's Vineyard Times with the story. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. And George, this story starts a little unexpectedly. It starts with a license renewal for selling used cars, which was also happening at the property here. Explain this for us.
Yeah, well, this is Trip Barnes, and as you said, he's a well-known public figure on the island. And he has a used car dealership at this same location. So the selectmen were going through, you know, all their license renewals for the year at this meeting, and all of a sudden they paused, and there was some discussion about this particular license at Barnes Truck Sales. And they said that they weren't going to take action on it that night, that there were too many outstanding enforcement issues. That piqued my curiosity. They didn't go into much more detail about it. And I asked for public records on that. The next day they were turned over. And it turns out that the building department, the health department, had cited this location for having these 8 illegal bedrooms. Trip Barnes has, through the years, he started what's known today as the Vineyard House. He's the type of person who take people in and give them a hand up. Housing is a particular issue here on the island. He's not renting these places for big money by any means. But the problem is they're not up to code. He's not zoned for having apartments or living quarters for rental in this particular place, and there's not proper smoke detectors, there's not proper carbon monoxide detectors in the basement apartments. So there are a number of issues. So the town has ordered him to cease renting these rooms. until he can bring the building up to code. But Barnes told me that's a tall order for this building. It's an older building. And he's really disappointed that the town has put his used car license into play here. He said that has nothing to do with what's happening inside the house or inside the building. So it's interesting. We've gotten a lot of comments back and forth, both on our website and on social media, people saying, you know, that they ought to allow him to bring it up to code, and other people saying they understand why the town officials have come down hard on this, because it's a dangerous situation for the people who are living there. So this is one that's going to, you know, come back again, I'm sure, because they've given him, you know, a set deadline for later this month to take care of things.
George, I want to ask you about something else going on at the paper there. You have a very fun essay project underway. It's called How We Saved Martha's Vineyard, and it projects folks into the future looking back at our present time. Is that right? Can you explain this?
Yeah. So we had a little brainstorming session toward the end of the year. We wanted to see, you know, it was 2020, and 2020, of course, is the year of the vision, right? So we wanted to look ahead, ask people to look ahead and see how we save Martha's Vineyard in 2030, 2040, or 2050. And we got a lot of great feedback on this. People were really interested in doing it, and some of them are very short and to the point. Like Geraldine Brooks wrote one, and she talks about Vexit, you know, Vexit, which would be vineyard exiting the United States and joining Canada. And then there are others that are more in depth. Our own Brian Dowd, who's been on your show previously, he wrote about sort of bringing all the towns together under one umbrella, Martha's Vineyard government, and not taking away from the character of the six communities that are here, but really making changes by becoming one island and being able to deal with the issues in that way. So there's a lot of them here. We're going to have more in the coming weeks, and we're really happy with the way this project turned out. And, you know, maybe some of these things will come to pass in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead to make the vineyard a better place than it already is, and to, as we said, save it. Because there are some issues that need addressing.
It is a fun project, and looking it over, you can see it's also a shorthand for the issues that people are really thinking about and really matter to people. That's George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
It's time now to check in with news from the State House. Earlier, I had a chance to speak with WCAI Beacon Hill reporter Mike Dean, taking a look at what we should keep an eye on in 2020 with both chambers now back at work. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Mike, for state lawmakers, there's a sense that 2020 is shaping up to be more significant than 2019. We know it's an election year. How much does that play into it, and what other factors are at work here?
Yeah, these even-numbered years are always the bigger years of the legislature's two-year session. So they go biannually, and so that means that the real deadline, when legislation drops dead, is coming in July, July 31st of 2020. Then they will go back into their districts and campaign for re-election. The idea here is to kind of get out of the state house early to campaign, but also so that those votes don't really factor into the politics of coming up towards Election Day, things like that. And, you know, as I'm sure that you've heard before from me, lawmakers need a deadline. And when that legislation does drop dead at that deadline, this is what pushes them to get their work done and really compromise on the major pieces of legislation that they need to get through. And as we've seen so far, much of 2019 was stuff that was expected to get passed in 2018, but failed at that deadline last time. So this is time for some big items from back then and some big items now that have come up upon the agenda for leaders to really prioritize and get made into law.
Let's talk about some of those items. Transportation, a big issue that lawmakers will continue to work on this year. And there's been talk of different ways to generate revenue around this, from congestion pricing to gas tax hikes. Will we see any of those become a reality?
Yeah, I think we'll definitely see some legislation passed. Whether or not it makes it into law is fairly likely, but we'll have to see if the governor objects to anything. Like you said, there are different ideas on the table right now. William Strauss is the co-chairman of the Transportation Commission. He's the House chair, and he wants to consider a gas tax. I think that that could lead Speaker DeLeo to potentially also support something like that. There's a lot of different ways to do this. One thing Governor Charlie Baker has made clear is that he does not want to raise the gas tax, but he is looking at something called TCI, which is a kind of a carbon cap and trade thing for fuel wholesalers. Now, it's pretty complicated, but needless to say, it would equate to about between 5 and 17 cents per gallon on the gas prices at the pump. That money would then be used to do things like improve regional bus services, roads and bridges, and yes, go towards the MBTA and transit, things like that. That's where what Baker wants to do. He doesn't want to raise the state's gas tax. We'll see what the House does and then the Senate later on this year. They say they want to get this debate done relatively soon. We could be seeing that in the winter months and into the spring. Whether or not Baker vetoes and it goes back to the legislature, that could complicate and make things go a little slower.
How about health care? Health care costs are something that the lawmakers have been trying to get under control for a while. Does it look like any legislation on that coming this year?
Reading the tea leaves on healthcare on Beacon Hill has become complicated the last couple of weeks. One of the big changes that happened was Jennifer Benson, the representative from Lunenburg, was the chair of the Health Finance Committee in the House, and she left for a private sector job, which made a lot of people around here think, oh, geez, is there not really going to be a bill coming out? Everyone expected a big bill to come out last session, and unfortunately, her predecessor, the chairman, Cocott from Northampton, passed away in office, and then that bill kind of got sent into different committee structures and with different people playing into it, and no bill was signed into law. It never actually passed. The House and Senate couldn't agree to one. Now we don't really know what a new version would look like. They just lost the chairwoman. Governor Baker has his own version of the bill. We don't really know where the House stands right now. The Senate is concentrating on prescription drug pricing control, which there could be some overlap there with what the governor wants, but I think a lot of people around here are not holding their breath to see a major health care bill get done this session.
The governor's State of the Commonwealth address is set for later this month. Any ideas about what he'll be talking about when he comes to the House chamber for that?
Yeah, probably some of the things that we already just mentioned, that TCI, that carbon cap and trade program that would raise gas prices, generate revenue for the state's kind of transit programs and roads and bridges, things like that. That's a multi-state thing. That's basically the entire East Coast would be involved in this, state by state, individually. And that is something that the governor has been a leader on and pushing very, very hard. As we've heard over and over again, housing is an issue. It certainly is on the Cape, as well as in Greater Boston. The governor wants to pass a bill that would kind of loosen up zoning restrictions to promote more housing construction. That's something that he's been asking for the legislature to pass for literally years now that they haven't moved on. They might move on it soon. Like I said, he's against the tax hikes on gas, but he might have some ideas about what the MBTA actually needs after that safety report that came out a few weeks ago saying that the T is not doing everything it can to remain safe. But those are really the high details, the high marks that Baker might address. He might surprise us as well. We'll have to see when he gives his address in the coming weeks.
That's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Thanks, Mike.
Good to be with you.
And that is what's been happening around the Cape and the islands, the South Coast, and up at the State House this week. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, and Mike Dean at Beacon Hill. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.